This is the Fish Golf Broadcast. If you're new here, leave while you can. If you've listened before and come back for more, they got a name for people like you. That name is called recidivism. Repeat offender! Not a pretty name, is it? Neither is the Fish Golf Broadcast.
On dieser Folge des Fish Golf Broadcasts, meine Gäste ist der deutsche Wundervater, Simon Lizotte. Simon, woran denkst du?
I was not prepared for you to start that way, even though that was the... Oh, that was so you to do that. I love it. Should I answer in German too?
If you'd like.
Ich denke an viele Sachen. Normalerweise so, worum dreht sich die Welt und das Leben? Und ich bin jetzt 31 und Papa und man fragt sich, warum das Ganze? Man weiß es nicht so genau.
All right, so here's the problem. We plumbed the absolute depths of my German high school class memories in order to construct maybe a passable sentence in question. And this is the kind of thing where, like, every time I try to order at a Mexican restaurant or something, I think, like, okay... I speak un poquito español, and I do speak un poquito Deutsch, but not
ein bisschen.
But not in real time.
Yeah. So what did you catch what I just said?
Not much.
Not much.
A word here and there, but yeah. I can't translate fast enough to keep up with whatever the next word is, and just the sentence construction doesn't.
Even me being such a native speaker for 21 years that I lived there, now being 10 years in the U.S., man, it's hard to string those sentences together in the right order.
Right. And in theory, it should be easier because, like, you know where your subject and your verb are supposed to be. But then there's a whole bunch of cases that are so unfamiliar to me.
It's languages don't make much sense. And English is one of them, by the way. You've probably seen TikToks where people describe, like, how you pronounce different words, like, same spelling, but you just pronounce them differently depending on what letter is where. It's, I mean, no language really makes sense. It's pretty wild in how they all evolved.
For sure. And the agreement within them that everything just kind of works.
It is wild. I don't, it's something I don't understand, like a lot of things. I don't understand about how we are here now. In this beautiful place, look at this, Airbnb life here, we're on the road. We're in Arkansas, Jonesboro, just living it up once again.
Tell you what, I need whoever's booking your Airbnbs to book mine.
Yeah.
Mine, the floors are not level, and we have a clock that resets itself every hour, and then minute 57 of the hour, it just kind of swings back up to the top. So that's weird.
Yeah, well, my road life and touring life has changed a lot in the last 2 years, I'm sure you can imagine. And one thing that I've learned in the last 10 years of touring is that I'm always and forever going to book my own stuff. I don't trust anyone anymore.
Okay.
So I booked this.
Okay, well, put me on your list.
Of course.
So I think I want to say that I was at one of the very first tournaments that you came to when... You and was it Avery the first year?
Mm-hmm.
Were traveling around in the Discmania RV. It was at Haywood Valley Disc Golf Course in Armucci, Georgia, northwest of Atlanta.
Eagle Eye Open?
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, you were there.
I was. And that I think that was my first pro tournament. And you were, there was a huge line of people to get like form feedback from you.
Ooh.
And I threw a couple hyzer flip shots and said, well, what do you think I can improve about that? And you said, what do you want to improve about that? And it was like, I don't know. Like, this is the only thing I know how to do is throw hyzer flips. And, well, I figured it out, but it took a really long time.
How did you do that tournament?
I missed cash.
Did we play together?
We did not, most likely, because you probably would have been on a...
I won. That was my first U.S. ever.
You probably would have been put on hole number one. Nobody knew who I was at that point. I was a nobody. I missed cash on the only scoring error I have ever had.
Nice.
and I resolved never to do it again.
Yeah, and now it's basically impossible to do it anymore because of the new rules we have on tour.
Yeah, I mean, altogether, probably an improvement. It means that somebody can't write down the wrong score, turn it in, and walk off. Like happened to me. So there's that.
Yes. I mean, unintentionally, it's a bummer, but if it's intentional, then... I mean, that's used to happen, too.
Yeah, for sure. It wasn't... I don't think it was intentional. It was just unfortunate and something I didn't know was really a possibility.
To get your score wrong?
Yeah. Had no idea. Wow. I was so fresh to disc golf at that point. So by this point, you are extremely Americanized. And you're still based in Massachusetts, right?
Yep.
But it seems to me that every 2 years since you got here, you've kind of floated the idea of where should I move? And you put out a Twitter or Instagram
yes.
poll.
Yes.
And everyone says Austin and Charlotte and wherever else. How seriously have you considered doing that? It seems like Maple Hill has been the base for quite a while.
Yeah, and actually the reason is not Maple Hill, surprisingly. The reason is because I met my wife there in 2017. Actually, my first ever trip to Massachusetts, I ended up getting stuck. It was kind of wild. Maple Hill was always the one course and the one event that I always missed out on every year because I used to go back to Europe all the time. And sure. with visa stuff, everything was not as easy to travel back and forth all the time.
Sometimes it's still not with visa stuff.
Yeah, you're right. I had recent troubles as well.
Okay, but back to Maple Hill in the foregone days.
Yeah, so I played Maple Hill in 2017 and met my wife there on a Tinder date. It worked. Mind-blowing of all the things
story.
I've heard about Tinder. Actually, meeting your wife on Tinder is kind of a trend, I feel like. At least it has been the last couple of years. I've heard a lot of successful Tinder stories. Yeah, so I'm very proud of that. I'm not ashamed at all that we are a Tinder date marriage. And she was working there. She was doing her master's degree, so she had to go to school there. So naturally, I just had to move in with her. And then she started working in a lab. She was doing like drug development research stuff, which Boston is, of course, like a hotspot for in America. So we just kind of settled to be there. And then when she got pregnant with our son 3 years ago now already, she stopped working. My career has been getting better and better. And kind of when she stopped working, I've been kind of like trying to push her towards let's get out of this terrible weather, even though, of course, Massachusetts has so many good things. If you Google best places to raise a family in the U.S., Massachusetts is number one. Education, safety, wealth. It's just like such a good state. Just such a safe place to raise a family.
The problem is that it's an uninhabitable wasteland for the bulk of the time that you're home in the winter.
I wouldn't go as far as to say like that extreme. It does feel like that, especially when it comes to like March. We had a snowstorm there last week.
It is currently the second week of April right now.
Yeah. I mean, I like winter, but these like 5 to 6 months of kind of just misery, I can't do it again. So yeah, and now she's pregnant again, by the way, and we're having a baby in 14 days. We're having our daughter.
That's great.
And what's holding us in Massachusetts mainly is that her mom lives there, and she's like my wife's best friend and our only help with the baby, because all my family's over in Germany, and she grew up in Puerto Rico, so all her family's in Puerto Rico. Some are in Florida, some are in Georgia. So our only support system, or her main support system when I'm on tour, which is a lot still, is her mom, who lives 15 minutes from us right now. And that's just something like I can't take from her. It would just like not be worth it.
Yeah, definitely not. Because like in all practicality, you have to keep roughly the same tour schedule. Even if you downsize it by 3 or 4 tournaments a year, that's still 20 tournaments that you have to be at in order to fulfill contracts, to keep your subscriber base, to stay notable in the pro tour field.
Yeah, I kind of agree. Sometimes I have thoughts. I wonder, like, what if I just stayed home and made like 1 or 2 YouTube videos a week? And my YouTube channel has been so wildly successful that I feel like more people would watch me if I did that. Because to make a featured card or lead card or get on Jomez is so hard nowadays that, yes, I'm at tournaments and people see that I'm there, the locals that come to the tournaments, and I can like sign discs and take photos and interact a bit with the fans. But I can also kind of do that through my YouTube channel, where we're like literally between 50 and 200,000 people tune in every time.
It sounds like there is a little bit of push and pull there for you. You as YouTube content creator, I don't think would be so successful without the high level play to back it up. Like, there's a lot of people out there who are doing slick edits or trick shots, but none of them won 4 Pro Tours last year.
That's true. No, of course, I know it goes hand in hand. And I have this massive advantage that I've been doing this for. This is my 11th season full-time on tour now. And yeah, I mean, I've been lucky to build my brand. I mean, Discmania just put me on this great spotlight on this big stage and gave me everything I could have ever asked for to be kind of the showman on tour. And it kind of fit my personality and character too, to just kind of be like the show-off kid and throw the crazy shots. And I was looking at some older footage of tournaments recently, because when I was doing these Simon lines and kind of these shots that no one else would take and commentators would like laugh at or whatever, I remember at the time, even when I was at the time rewatching the rounds, like, it didn't seem like that different or cool or special to me what I was doing. I was like, just, yeah, whatever. But now looking back, I'm like, holy cow, like, I was really, really different with some of the shots I was throwing. Like, I'm watching back now what I was throwing like 10 years ago. I'm just like watching the video, I'm just shaking my head like, what was I doing? Like, no wonder I never won a tournament.
But once again, you wouldn't have the content creator success story if people didn't want to see the Simon line and stuff.
I know, it all worked out. I wish I could say it was planned that way, but it kind of just fell. It all fell into place.
It worked because, like, you didn't win, but every single time you threw the shot that people walked away talking about. And there's a lot of value in that in terms of marketability. In a way, I don't know if there is a Cole Redallen throwing his ridiculous lines if there's not a Simon when he is starting to look up YouTube form videos.
I mean, yeah, even touring pros now have talked to me about how I was like one of their role models and how they were trying, like Ezra Aderholt is an example. He was straight up with me and it was like, yeah, when I was starting throwing backhands, like, you were what I was trying to be like. I guess I was just throwing hard and far and high, and it's very fun. I mean, everyone knows that, how fun it is to throw really like high
big shots,
and far.
Yeah. It's not entirely you, but I think that style is a real bridge between, like, let's say Ken Climo's dominance or Nate Doss's dominance, where they threw solid controlled shots. They didn't go for highlights because they kind of didn't have to. They could just outscore everybody on execution. And then Macbeth in, say, 2015 or so, every time I got to play with him, he was trying really hard shit. Complicated three-angle shots, running every eagle putt. And I'd walk away being like, well, he beat me by 6, but he also just left 4 bonehead strokes out there by
That's
being
right.
too aggressive.
And That's right.
I think you helped up the ante in the meta of how pros approach shots, because with your power, you could throw something that wasn't complicated, but was aggressive and would kind of break holes, make them way easier to score on.
Yeah, no, I agree. I agree right there. I had a funny conversation with Yuli one day about Macbeth, and Yuli was like, I'm there with Paul, like, playing, like, head-to-head. Like, I'm, like, doing my best to battle with Macbeth, who, this is now, like, 5-6 years ago, this conversation, when Paul was, like, at one of his prime years.
Sure.
And Yuli was like, I don't understand this guy. He has, like, this straightforward shot, but then he tries to get from A to B in, like, the hardest way possible. That's what Yuli said about Macbeth. And I wonder why Paul did that.
I mean, I mentioned that you would throw the shot that people would keep talking about. If he eagles that 970-foot par 5 through the woods, people are going to remember that. So the complexity is worth it in his head, and like just the confidence in executing that is critical. Can you talk a little bit about the role confidence has played in your career, whether it's high points, low points, or everything in between?
Yeah, I like the term unconditional confidence. I don't know if that's actually a phrase people use, but that's always what I've used kind of to describe my... I've used it to describe Paul McBeth's game back when he was winning every tournament, because one of the most frequent messages I would get on social media about people asking for tips was, how do I get over a bad hole? How do I regain confidence? How do I find my putt after missing a couple putts? Like, basically trying, like, how to gain confidence back. And I feel like, as of very recently, in my entire career, I've never struggled with confidence, because I've literally been playing since I'm 2 years old, which at this point is 29 years. I never felt like I was a good teacher. I've done a lot of clinics, and I've tried to teach people and trying to explain what to do or how to do it. I don't think I'm very good at it, because I feel like I don't know. I've always tried to explain it, like, when I try to think about how I throw a disc, it's someone else trying to explain, like, how they walk. Like, of course we can all walk and it seems like such a simple move, but try to, like, break it down and explain to someone who can't walk right how to walk right. It seems like impossible, because you just do it. You don't think about how to walk when you're walking. And it was, for me, always like I don't think about throwing when I'm throwing. I just do it, because I've always been doing it for so long, and since I was so young, that it was just something I never had to worry about it, because I never had to think about it.
For sure. I totally identify with that, because like I played a lot of Ultimate in high school and then all through college, and only then did I pick up disc golf. So throwing golf shots, that was just a refinement of what I already knew. You know, taking an Ultrastar, putting it on an IO angle, letting it flip up and ride, and Ultrastars need height. You keep two hands on the disc for control when you're transitioning between forehand and backhand. Golf discs have a lot more variability and potential for, you know, distance and shaping and stuff like that. Because there's not thought when you are doing stuff in game and Ultimate, the pacing of disc golf would really wreck my brain. But I also can't explain it to people, because it's just like, well, you see the shot, you throw the shot. That's what you do. What's so hard about that? This is very easy. It's only when I've tried to learn new stuff, like throwing committed Anheuser angles or not changing planes on a forehand swing, that I've kind of developed a new skill but fucked my brain up at the same time. Has that happened to you? Or do you just have so much ingrained knowledge over 29 years that
I think the problem sticks? I don't think I've tried to learn a new skill since I'm like 12 years old. At least talking about disc golf. I can't think of anything I would have tried to learn. Which isn't, it's one of these things, one of my biggest personality flaws is that I'm a good enough person. I don't need great. I don't need outstanding. I just need good enough. That's how I was in school. My grades, all I cared about was good enough. And teachers would always ask me, like, why don't you try? One thing Yussi, who was my boss for 15-ish years, everyone saw the potential I had, from my high school teachers to my disc golf friends and family and bosses, whoever. They always like, you have so much talent. Like, why don't you try to learn and get really good? You would be the best. The amount of time I've heard that, oh, it used to drive me crazy when someone would try to talk me into trying harder. And yeah, I don't know why. I've always been just a person who was like, I'm good enough. I don't have to win. I'm good enough, and I'm happy that way. I don't know. I just don't know how it feels to want to try so hard to learn something new in disc golf.
This is the least relatable podcast we've ever heard. Again, this guy won how many pro tours last year and how many career. But this is a universal thing, Simon, where it's very easy to wake up in the morning and hit the snooze button and go back to bed rather than getting up and grinding out a workout at the gym before you go to work. It's very easy to say, yeah, I'll have dessert today. It's very easy to like just let stuff slide and, you know, make life suck a little more for future Simon. And in the moment, you're kind of making like the easy choice. Cumulatively, though, it does stack up. Is there a little part of you now that feels like if you had like really dedicated and sacrificed for a couple years, let's say 15 years ago, that your life or career would be or feel any different?
I don't know. I really don't know. I've asked myself that question so many times. You know, a handful of years ago, I was at a point in disc golf where I thought I never want to play again because I just felt like everyone that I was working with was like thinking I'm not trying hard enough and I'm not, and I should be better than I am. And I'm just out there kind of like not really giving it my all. And in Discmania's culture, it was always about, I mean, they want to be the best disc golf company in the world, and everyone from the office people to all the staff, whatever, everyone put in their all to make Discmania and disc golf as successful as possible. And I often had the feeling that I was out there slacking, which was not always a good feeling. And I remember just a point where I was just sitting around and being like, I don't want to do this anymore. I would rather literally do anything than keep touring and playing disc golf.
What made that pass?
Well, I think one thing that made that pass was me just totally accepting who I am, which is a good enough person. Like, I've always asked myself, like, why am I not like Paul? Like, why don't I go to the gym all the time and try to get physically in the best shape I can possibly be? Why don't I go to the putting green every day for an hour and putt 500 putts? Why don't I like playing more practice rounds? Why doesn't winning a disc golf world title drive me, like the want to get this world title or any major or any, like actually name any tournament or title you can win in disc golf. Like
Eagle Eye Open.
Eagle Eye Open. Like, why doesn't that drive me? Like, why don't I want that so bad that I will do all the sacrifices it takes to get there, which is what most athletes I always thought should do. Because if it's your job, my job, I've never had a real job. My job my whole life was throwing freaking frisbees. And I can't even take that seriously or try my hardest. I was just always okay with how good I was. And why do I have to put in more work than I want to? And it drove me so far that I just didn't want to play anymore because everyone around me wanted me to do better. And I was just, I don't know, one day I just decided to accept that I'm okay with not wanting to be the greatest, not wanting to do all the sacrifices it takes to be a freaking human disc golf machine. Like, that just wasn't me. And I've watched countless videos on this kind of stuff, and there's other people like that too, even in sports. People that are not driven by, I need to be the best. That was just not me. What drives me was, I want to have fun and make people watching have fun.
So can you talk a little bit about the gameplay shift that seemed to result in fewer of those highlight shots, but more successful tournament finishes? It feels like there has to be some switch that gets turned.
Well, there was.
Okay.
But not voluntarily. It was an injury. I've talked about this a couple of times. My elbow got basically screwed up when COVID hit, and I started really pumping out YouTube videos almost on a daily basis. I think I did like 4 months in a row where every other day I would upload a video, and a lot of them were ace runs, trick shots, you know, just stuff where you would throw like 50 to 100 shots in a row, sometimes hard shots, and I would just not warm up properly because, you know, I'm lazy. I would not do really anything. I would not eat right to make my body healthy and make my ligaments actually want to throw 100 hard shots in a row. So I did everything basically wrong and kind of just like childish and naive. You know, I've my whole life, I've just kind of been lucky and never really had to had worries about much. So I guess that's just the side effect of me kind of being a bit lazy sometimes. And my elbow started tweaking on me after the legendary table video where I took my old coffee table to a baseball field and tried skipping discs off of it into a basket. That video is so tragically bad too. It's oh my god, you need to watch it one day. But I literally took a broken coffee table to a baseball field and started skipping shots into baskets, and I kept going further and further back to see how far I could do this trick shot. And I don't know how many discs I threw that day at this stupid table and how hard I threw discs at that table. It was unbelievably stupid. But I had to do it. I get like obsessed with shots sometimes where I'm like, I can't stop until I make it. It's really crazy how I have this like thing with trick shots or aces where like I literally can't stop.
Where
I
you
have
do
to
want to try. Where you give it your all.
Oh, absolutely. When it comes to a shot that I want to make, there's literally no stop until I make it. I don't know if that's a normal thing to have or if it's kind of a unique thing to have that you just can't stop. It's like you're obsessed. I'm obsessed with making these shots.
I'm just so interested in how this like this micro thing captivates you, but the macro of a tournament goal or being the best disc golfer doesn't. I mean, it's fine. Like this is your mind. I'm not trying to resolve it. It's just interesting to me.
Well, quick sidetrack before I get back to my elbow injury. I went to a really cool boot camp with Eagle in Switzerland in 2017. And we did a lot of mental coaching as well, like sports therapy kind of thing. One of our tasks was to write down on a piece of paper what our goals are for our career. I don't remember if it was for the next season or for our career. It doesn't really matter what it was, but Eagle, within 5 minutes, had the entire paper full of goals of what he wanted to achieve. And my paper was blank after 30 minutes. I could not put into words what one of my goals was in disc golf, what I wanted to achieve, which I found was so bizarre. Because if you watch any, like, these stereotypical motivational speeches or anything where people, successful people, tell you, like, how to get to the top or how to become successful is
in very alpha voices.
Yeah, Arnold Schwarzenegger, for example. He's like, you have to set goals, and on these way to your major goals, you need some smaller goals, like a little stepping ladder on how to get to your big goals. And I mean, that's like, it makes logical sense. It's probably a proven concept that works for a lot of people. And I always question, like, wait, why can't I phrase not one goal? Because to me, it seems so, the word that comes to mind right now is shallow, but it's probably not the right word. Like, if I write down my goal is to win a major, or my goal is to win the world championships, like, how is that a goal? That didn't seem like something I would ever write down as not one of my goals.
Let me tell you one of my goals for this year. I want to play an entire round and then an entire tournament where I believe 100% in every single shot that I throw. And that has nothing to do with how I place. Winning a major, like, you can do everything right, and Gannon Burr can go off. You can throw the best rounds of your life, and you can land, or you can throw the best shots of your life, and you can land 2 feet out of bounds and have to go back to a drop zone. Like, there's so many uncontrollables that go into like the big corporate goal of winning a major, but it's almost like abstracting the goal into things that you can control, for me, makes it more manageable. So I get it. Like, winning a major doesn't change who you are. Winning a Pro Tour event might not make you happier, because the very next week, that doesn't fucking matter.
It really
doesn't. They'll put you on the feature card and you got to go do an interview on press day, but you start at zero again.
Yeah, that's really what I've learned. Winning has never made me happy in disc golf at all. Almost the opposite. It almost made me like more anxious and depressed. To be fully honest, one of the worst experiences I've ever had in disc golf was throwing the distance world record. which ever since I've been a little kid was one of my main quote-unquote goals that I had was I want to go out to the desert and freaking try to throw the world record. And I did on my first attempt. And afterwards, I felt so depressed, and I don't even know why. There's probably some good psychology behind that on why when you achieve like a big goal like that, you feel like weird afterwards and like kind of depressed a bit.
You certainly hear this from, you know, people who go to the Olympics. You hear this from coaches who win their first NCAA title or something. You did it. What now?
Yeah. Yeah, I guess that was one of those points. And also I got like a lot of attention online that whole thing had. And like, I never liked that much attention. I always used to say back in the day, this is now a while ago, but I always said second place is my favorite place. That was back in Germany because I used to win when I would play in Germany. I won basically every tournament ever since I turned like 15. But sometimes I would get second place and I would always say second place is my favorite because second place means you did really well, but you don't get all the attention that the winner gets.
No speech.
You don't have to do a speech. Yeah, the speech was a big part.
I'm Gavin Babcock, and I listen to the Fish Golf Broadcast while I live in a simulation.
I'm Ian Burchett, and I listen to the Fish Golf Broadcast while I do fieldwork.
You know, I spent all of Season 1 in this very ad break saying that we would never barrage you with 11 minutes of droning external ads. But lately, I've had a change of heart. The integrity of this show absolutely has a price. We're talking lake house money. Private island money. Lake house on a private island money. But until that hypothetical benevolent corporate overlord speaks up, though, this show is entirely supported by your support of me and my sponsors. Fish Stamp Discraft discs are available in-store and online at daddydiscgolf.com, dischub.com, and treemagnets.com, and fishdiscgolf.com when I'm not traveling. You can save 10% at Grip Equipment with the code FISHGIFT10 at checkout, unless you're a fool who likes spending full price on disc golf bags. And of course, our name is derived from Disc Golf Bra, whose media channels and website you should visit for outstanding New England content. And now, more mutual hostility between Fish and the guest.
So I definitely want to loop back to this conversation point, but we need to finish up on your elbow injury.
Yes, please. So the elbow injury basically slowed me down with, you know, elbow injuries are really sucky. In sports where you have to throw a lot, elbows are freaking not really what you want to hurt. Because there's so many different things that can go wrong. I tried a lot of different things with elbow. I got MRIs and I talked about getting surgery and all that stuff. And I found a really good, shout out Disc Golf Strong, Seth Muncy hooked me up with like one of the best physical therapists and sports guys who works with like professional baseball players in Boston. And I would see him every week, multiple times per week. And he basically told me that my elbow will never be good again. It's just screwed up. I could try surgery. He didn't really recommend it. He said, we can get your elbow strong enough again that you can throw and you can compete on a regular basis. But you can't go out and just throw these crazy hard shots over and over and over again. It's just those days are done. And you might still feel tweaks every now and then. It's just part of how it goes. And the weird thing about my injury actually now is that the less I throw, the worse the injury gets. So if I don't throw for a week or two and then throw again, almost every throw starts tweaking on my elbow. But if I throw every day, it hurts less and less and less. Which is another reason I want to leave Massachusetts, because I just can't go out there and throw every day. And then after every off season, or every time I go home between tournaments and it's just crappy weather at home, I come back to the next tournament, play a practice round, and every throw my elbow hurts, which is not good preparation for the courses we are playing.
Do you have a basement? You need a net somewhere or a garage?
I probably could do it if I had the discipline and the drive to actually try ever. It's kind of sad.
Do you think you could afford to hire somebody to put a net in your basement?
The sad thing is I actually already have one in my basement. I just choose not to use it. I am so lazy. It's unbelievable.
But through the course of your rehab and with this doctor's advice, you kind of had to back off from lots of shots and from max effort shots.
Correct. I couldn't throw like crazy angles anymore. I couldn't throw like high over the trees really hard. And basically anything above like 90% effort would hurt. I was lucky that 90% effort for me still meant like 550 feet of distance. So
that's pretty great, huh?
Yeah, very lucky. I kind of was forced to throw quote unquote boring, smart shots. And that first year when I came back, that was the 2022 season. I won 4 pro tours that year, which blew my mind. It still blows my mind looking back at those. They all don't really make sense. OTB Open was good. Besides that, the rest doesn't really make sense. And then the next year after, last season, I won 2 more. So I won 6 in the last 2 seasons. Pretty wild. And I have to thank my elbow injury, probably mainly because it made me throw a bit smarter, more consistent shots. And with my game, it's always been that way, that when I'm on, I'm on. It's not very often that I'm on, but when it's on, it's on. So when I'm on, it just I get into this zone where suddenly like gaps start looking bigger, the basket starts looking wider. I don't know if you've ever experienced something like that where you like actually visually, you can see visual changes in the course.
I found a little putting nirvana a couple days ago, and it lasted about 10 minutes. And
okay.
It didn't matter how I putted. It didn't matter the spin. Everything worked.
Yeah.
And the ability to just find one link center mass was effortless.
It's so fascinating how that works. I think it mainly probably just is confidence in your skill, what creates these visions or how things look to you. I remember even as a kid, like when I was 12, 13 years old playing, I remember once asking one of my friends, all my friends when I was a kid were way older than me, like in their late 30s, like all the disc golfers back then in Germany. And I was like, do you know this feeling when you're like 40 feet from the basket, but the basket looks like it's like right next to you and you can just like put your disc basically in it? And they just looked at me like confused, like no. And I called it the zoom look, where you can like zoom in and like pull stuff closer to you. And that was, I think, really early stages of like being like in the zone, just being like so confident in what you can do that you can literally make stuff look bigger. And recently I had similar experiences. I think, I don't remember what year it was, not long ago, 1 or 2 years ago, where I would get to a course that I've played many, many times over the last couple of years, and the same gaps would look wider to me. I'm like, did they make this wider? I asked like card mates, like, no, it's the exact same. Like, this looks like unmissable to me right now. And it's so crazy how stuff changes. And there's the opposite too, where you get to the same gap a year later and you're like, whoa, this looks...
How have I ever made this?
This looks freaking tiny. And that's where I'm at right now with my game, because I'm playing so questionable right now, where I'm like, some shots I just look at, I'm like, wait, last year this was such an easy shot for me, and now I'm like terrified to throw a disc that like that. So yeah, it goes both directions, but I mean, mostly I've been lucky that it goes towards the positive.
I think this is a really underrated ebb and flow of being on tour, that you go to the same courses year after year, and you know, your game has changed subtly, your discs are different, especially when you have a major sponsor change like you had, but you're just not the same person that you were one calendar year before. Sometimes has there ever been a temptation to try to fight that, or are you able to, you know, get a couple practice rounds in and embrace that I've had success here before, why not now?
I don't know. I feel like over the years I've tried kind of everything when it comes to mental game. I have been feeling like the older I get, the harder it gets, because I feel like the older I get, the more scared I am of stuff for some reason, the more I worry about things. There's probably some evolutionary benefit to doing that, but for getting older, you just know absolutely. More outcomes or something.
Right, right. So I I joke about this on maybe every fourth podcast. Your prefrontal cortex, which is the part of your brain that helps with decision making, doesn't really mature until about age 26. So I like to joke that, like, you know, all these fucking kids that we have to play with every week who haven't seen a 60-footer on an elevated basket with OB right behind it, they didn't love. They just don't have a good actuarial sense of what the smart play is, so they just run it anyway and make it. Whereas, geez, I've been laying that up for quite a while now.
I'm at a point now where I'm playing, you know, a lot of my practice rounds are with these jokesters over here, all these young kids.
Oh, they're, yep.
They play practice rounds, and they sometimes throw, like, at least 3 shots on a hole, sometimes 4 or 5. And then they also play, like, 3 or 4 practice rounds leading up to a tournament. That means on any given hole, they've thrown, like, 12 to 25 shots. And I'm just standing there. I throw 1 shot, and I play 1 practice round. Sometimes I'll throw 2 if I throw a terrible shot. But I'm like, if I have 25, or let's say 18. If I have 18 different shots in my mind that I threw in the last 3 days on this hole,
it's just clutter.
I'm literally going to melt, and I'm not going to know what to do. I'm not going to know which disc to choose. I don't know. There's so many good and bad outcomes that I've already seen. Like, I don't want to have all these options in my head. I see the shot. I've done them all millions of times, and I throw that shot. I want 1 option, maybe 2, and that's all I can handle right now. But these kids need to throw as many discs as they possibly can handle, of course. It is very fun, and I miss those days where I could go out and just throw hundreds of shots on every hole. But right now, it's 1 practice round and mostly just 1 shot, and then keeping it very simple, because overthinking is really the biggest downfall, I think, of most athletes.
Yeah, no doubt. No doubt. Kind of going back to where we had left off, you mentioned being anxious and depressed as a consequence of something that nominally was successful in setting the distance record. One of the most interesting topics to me that I wanted to talk about with you is the kind of affable, approachable, relatable image that you have cultivated through your YouTube presence, as well as just like meeting fans in person on the course. Do you struggle with who you are and what you're feeling versus your obligation to the brand identity that you've created for Simon Lizotte Professional Disc Golfer?
Yeah, it's an ongoing battle almost every day. I mean, I want to be the guy that can just always have a smile. Good, if I throw a good shot or a bad shot, if I'm having a good day or a bad day, I would love to just always enjoy disc golf, enjoy what I'm doing, enjoy traveling, and be nice to everyone. I would love to love when anyone comes up to me and wants to talk to me, because that is pretty great when people want to come talk to you. But sometimes it's just hard to deal with it over and over again, because unfortunately, when you're in a position like me, I get asked mostly the same things in a loop 50 times a week.
How do you like the course?
Yeah, I mean, one of the main things I get after I throw like a really good shot that I'm really happy with, and people will start asking me if I threw a putter. That's like one of the main things I've dealt with my entire life. And another thing I get a lot is people like will blabber random German words at me all the time.
Real quick, do you at all envy the Finns because their cuss words are not basically direct cognates of English cusses?
Are the German ones? They kind of are.
Scheiße, Ficken.
Yeah, like, yeah, you're right.
You don't have to squint too hard to know what that means.
Yeah, Finnish is, those guys are. But you know what? I can say much worse things in German than those, and people won't know what it means. So
sure, you just have to be like a little more creative with what you're saying.
Yeah, I've definitely learned to be creative over the years.
So do you take offense when podcasters who are way too clever for their own good or anybody else's initiate with German?
No, The good thing was that I wasn't expecting it. When I'm on the disc golf course, I always expect it, and then it always feels like kind of like roll your eyes, like, yeah, whatever. I've heard this a million times. So, yeah, back to your question. It is very difficult sometimes to be that guy that I want to be, or that I've created, or that I am. That were three different things in one.
Sure.
I don't even know how to call it anymore, what I am. It's just so weird. Before, I don't manage this every single day, but usually when I get to the course, I give myself about 10 seconds where I just sit in the car and just mentally prepare for being in a good mood or just being okay with whatever someone throws at me, smiling it off, and then I exit my car and go be nice to everyone. And if I don't do that, I sometimes catch myself being kind of an asshole out there and rejecting people and just being a bit, yeah, really not the person that I want to be, but sometimes just am. I mean, I think we all know how that feels when you're just sometimes like, oh, no, not right now.
I mean, the tough part is this is your day at work, but it also might be some kid's first time at a Pro Tour event or first time playing disc golf or first time meeting somebody that they've watched 100 times on YouTube.
Yeah, and it's what always was tricky for me with those situations was, can I play my best and perform my best and also at the same time be that guy that says hi to every fan, signs every disc, takes photos, and is super like approachable for everyone? Can I do both at the same time equally well, or does one kind of mean the other one's going to suffer a bit? Like, if I want to be like as focused as I possibly can, there's no way I can go talk to people. Like, that's not how we work as humans, I think, where we can just completely get out of the zone and then just jump back right into it when you have to go throw. So, yeah, I don't know. It's a bit different from week to week. I mean, some tournaments you have a different mental approach, and sometimes you just want to be a bit more serious, be a bit more to yourself, and then the next tournament, you're like, oh, whatever. I'm out here. It's nice weather. Let's just go out and have fun. Be nice to everyone. And sometimes I feel like I really figured it out and I'm so happy on the course and nothing rattles me. And then the next round, I taco my putter because I get so so frustrated. Last tournament in Houston, I tacoed my putter on hole 16 after I missed like a 30-footer. Oh, I was so embarrassed afterwards. And I don't even know why I got angry. Like, I was in such a good mood. And just suddenly, like, I threw the worst shot of my career, it feels like, on one of the holes. I was playing so well. I was, like, 7 down through 12 holes. And then hole 13 or whatever that hole is, I threw the simplest upshot. I threw the perfect tee shot. And then I threw the simplest upshot OB. And the OB was not even in play or anywhere in my mind. Like, something small like that just rattled me, and it threw me completely off my mood. And from there, everything, I was just, I was not in a good spot anymore. but I'm not as bad as I used to be anymore. I used to, like, literally book flights home during a round because I was so upset. I would literally text my wife, or back then girlfriend, and just be like, I don't know why I'm out here. I don't enjoy this. I just want to go home. I'm not really there anymore. I found a very good balance and finding more of the joy in how lucky I am now with what I got to do for so long. And with the new contract I signed, a lot of things have gotten a lot easier.
In terms of just having support from your sponsors? Like, I don't need you to bad talk Discmania. Like, clearly they were very good for you for a long time.
Yeah, I mean, disc golf has changed so much in the last 4 years. Like, we all know, like, it's night and day, especially for, like, the top 2%. It has changed so much. And, yeah, things are just different now. I mean, everything has changed, really. Discmania was awesome. But with Discmania, I had this really weird thing that I was so inside of Discmania. I was such a big part of everything that was going on.
Basically from the beginning, right?
I mean, Disweenia was established in 2007. I started working with Yussi in 2008, which was back then Innova Europe, which he was also running. And then I switched to Discmania at the end of 2012. So I wasn't there from the very beginning of Discmania, but Discmania's first year in the U.S. when they had a base in California, I was like part of building that in the U.S., right next to the Innova warehouse back then in Rancho, just outside of L.A. I had such a close relationship with Yussi and Avery, of course, and everyone working behind the scenes. And I knew so many things that were going on financially and future plans. Like, I was just so in it that even if Discmania was going to offer me something like MVP offered me, I wouldn't want to take it. It was just such a bizarre thing because I knew too much about how Discmania works as a company. I knew too much about what UC's goals were that I just knew that if they paid me like that, it just didn't make sense. Like, they could have, and they kind of offered to, but I was just like, that doesn't make sense. Like, I don't want you guys to pay me that much.
I'm sure you've discussed this on other platforms, and it's not like you don't have places people go to listen to you talk about Frisbee. But let's talk a little bit about your vlogging. Because, like, yes, there are financial considerations to all of this, whatever, whatever. You have been able to basically do what you want in throwing trick shots or practice rounds or, you know, whatever other challenges you've gotten into with your vlog series. How much creative direction have others tried to provide for this, and what does monetizing that look like to you?
I was always into making videos, even before I really started the YouTube thing, which was the end of 2018, where I really started taking it more seriously. But even before that, I was really into videos. Eagle used to do a lot of vlogs back in the day on tour, so I always knew this is something I wanted to do, and I never wanted to do it to like make it big or make money off of it. I just knew I like wanted to do it because I enjoyed
it. Because
it was fun.
Welcome to the Fish Golf Broadcast.
Yeah, it is just so fun. Just making content that people enjoy is so fun. It's like my favorite thing. People kind of tried. I mean, Discmania wanted me to make vlogs for the Discmania YouTube channel because they saw like how successful I was with my YouTube channel. And they wanted Discmania's YouTube channel to also grow, so they offered me money to make vlogs for their channel. And they offered me, like, kind of significant money to do so. So I was like, yeah, I'll make you a vlog for $1,000. Are you kidding me? It takes me 4 hours, and I'm done. And I don't think I ever finished one video for their channel. Because I don't even know why, but it just, I hated the whole thing, feeling like I'm making it for someone else. I just wanted it to make it for me, and I didn't even care if they gave me $10,000. I still don't think I would have done it or enjoyed it. I thought I was going to, but then during the process I felt like, oh, now it feels like I have to do it, and that didn't feel good at all.
And that they're expecting a particular image to come out.
And now I felt like I had pressure that it's entertaining and good and successful, because if I make a video and it kind of sucks on my channel and not many people watch it, it's like, whatever, I just make another one. But if that goes on Discmania's channel, I feel like a weird pressure that it has to be good and it has to be successful. And I never liked that kind of feeling. So there was multiple tries. I think at some point even the Disc Golf Network reached out and wanted to buy some of my vlogs. And I think, again, I kind of tried and it never turned out. I did do something for the Disc Golf Networks, which actually turned out to be pretty cool and pretty fun. I was super burnt out afterwards because it was way too much for me. I don't know if you ever watched the Finding the Line series. That's like a course design series I made with Avery. This is now 3 or 4 years ago, where we basically went to New Hampshire and designed a course, and I just vlogged the process, like a 6-episode. They were all like 10 to 20 minutes long. And I did the whole thing by myself, from filming to editing to directing. I did everything. And the Disc Golf Network published that. And that was actually pretty successful on the network. But it was way too much work for me, and I hated, again, doing stuff for other people. I just wanted to do it for myself. I've been offered from editors. Everyone, like so many people have reached out to me and said, oh, I'll help you. I'll edit your videos for free or whatever. Or all kinds of stuff. Camera people reaching out, trying to help be my cameraman on tour or be my cameraman when I'm home. And at the end of the day, I've just learned that I want to do it myself for myself. And that's all. I want to film my own videos. I want to edit my own videos. And I want to decide what I do.
I so much identify with that. Potential sponsors, I know you're out there. But if I feel like I have to make a deliverable that you'll be happy with, I might not be able to say fuck anymore. I might not be able to find creative German cuss words. Also, I might not be able to make an acrostic. Have you gone back and listened to episodes and tried to find acrostics with words or sentences that I start with?
Well, talking about monetizing and getting paid for stuff, I didn't want to monetize my YouTube channel. And now, I think, I don't remember what number it exactly was, but I remember the day where I monetized my YouTube channel and UC basically forced me to. Like, I didn't want people to have to watch a stupid YouTube ad before one of my... Damn, I'm like so used to not cussing, but now I'm on a platform where I'm allowed to cuss. I thought my videos did not qualify quality-wise to have a stupid YouTube ad in front of them. I thought my videos aren't good enough to warrant someone having to watch a stupid ad before watching my stupid video. But UC was just like, no, you have to do it. Like, everyone nowadays is so used to watching ads. Like, no one's going to care. No one's going to judge you for putting ads there. No one's even going to notice, probably. And you're just going to make thousands of dollars. Like, it's a no-brainer. You have to do it. And I got convinced, and I did it. I still don't put many ads. I put one at the front, depending on the length of the video, sometimes one in the middle and one at the end, which for YouTube standards is very, very few. Usually people go like every 2 minutes.
Yeah.
Like, I remember doing Vlogmas last year with Drew Gibson, and Drew Gibson is a very interesting character and has very different opinions than me on a lot of things. And he was like, oh, fuck him. I throw ads as many as I can. If people want to watch me throw discs, they got to watch ads. And I couldn't really relate with that. I was like, no, I don't want people to watch any ads to watch me throw a frisbee. But at the end of the day, I have to say that I kind of agree with UC now that watching like one ad is like so normal.
And it's not that bad.
No one really notices, and people can have YouTube Premium where you don't even see the ads anymore. And YouTube is surprisingly lucrative. Like, I used to follow YouTubers with like millions and millions of followers and millions of views on every video. And I thought with my like 50,000, 30 to 50,000 views back then per video, I was like, this is going to be like kind of, I don't know, like $20, $50 maybe. Like, how does YouTube pay more for that small of stuff if they have people who get millions times that?
Mm-hmm.
But then I get my first check and it's like $1,500 for a month. I'm like, what? And then that kept growing, and there were some months where I would make like $8,000, and I posted like 5 or 6 videos.
Boy.
And then Vlogmas.
Even in suburban Boston, that's a rent check.
Yeah. One of the Vlogmases, I made $25,000 off of just ad revenue. And I don't even do sponsorships. It's just ad revenue. And that made me think, like, what do these guys make that make millions of views? Like, it must be insane.
I think it also matters the level of engagement. If you are getting people to watch 80% of the runtime of every video, that's a hell of a lot better than somebody who clicks on a Mr. Beast video and goes to like the highlighted spot, watches for 45 seconds and goes away.
Yeah, I gotta say, I'm a big Mr. Beast fan.
I've never watched any of his stuff.
Really?
True.
Wow, that is interesting. Some of it is very good. Some of it is trash, but most of it is very good, in my opinion.
I'm a weird consumer of stuff in that, like, I don't watch a whole lot of disc golf. I don't listen to any other disc golf podcasts right now. I don't keep up with who's on TikTok or who's, like, the sensation this week on YouTube, whatever. I just don't care about it. So, and it doesn't make my life better or worse to not care.
Yeah, I've really enjoyed your podcast a lot, also for the reason that you have guests on that aren't on all the disc golf podcasts constantly. Like, you have people on that, of course, I know of because I've been on tour for so long, and it's very interesting to me to hear stuff from them because you don't hear stuff from them on all the mainstream podcasts because there's the same five people in a loop.
Honestly, I would love to win a tournament and be invited to be on five different podcasts the next week on a loop, but until that happens, I'm going to keep making content that's vaguely current but not specific to particular events or places.
Yeah, I appreciate it. I think it's good and different.
Good. All right. Well, Simon, thank you so much for talking about your process of improvement or just staying the same average dude. Thanks for talking about kind of the boundaries that you've had to set for yourself in terms of fan interaction. Thanks for talking about, like, how you've cultivated one of the most successful media followings in disc golf. Like, honestly, I've thought about starting a YouTube channel as well. I don't really know video editing, but I'm sure you didn't at one point also. My feeling was always like, Simon is way too far ahead. What's the point of, like, having 200 subscribers when he's got 80,000? And that was, I don't know how many years ago 80,000 passed.
Not that long ago, like 3 years maybe.
Oh yeah, that's not that long. That's a long time in terms of the disc golf ecosystem right now.
Sure.
If you enjoyed this podcast and want to lavish praise on me, you can find me on Instagram and whatever the fuck Twitter is at fish58320. And if somehow you found this stupid niche podcast with this stupid niche host, but people don't yet know how to find you, Simon, where can people go to find you and complain vigorously about all of your terrible opinions and lack of desire?
People can find me on Instagram. That's basically my main outlet. And I'm really trying to get that YouTube channel back up and running. I try so hard. Right now it's mainly like one or two videos a month. I'm slacking, but I'm also very busy. I'm busier than ever, and I have another kid coming in 14 days. But yeah, YouTube, Instagram, Simon Lazotte, pretty straightforward. And I think that's all. I think I don't do anything else. I like to keep it very simple.
That's smart. All right, good luck with critter number two.
Thank you.
That's a wrap on this week's Fish Golf Broadcast. Join us next week to fritter away more of your ever-waning life force on two jabronis talking about Frisbee. Please support the show, if you're able, by shopping for fish stuff at fishdiscgolf.com, Daddy Disc Golf, Disc Hub, Tree Magnets, and Disc Golf Bras websites. You can still save 10% at Grip Equipment with the code FISHGIFT10, and please tell a friend about this show. Unless you don't have any friends, but that's your problem, not mine.